I'm also getting married. I'm treating this woman, when I treat with this woman, I'm treating this woman with how God wants me to treat this woman. There's a this higher power. Not that you shouldn't treat your woman in a good way anyway. No, you should. You must treat your woman in a good way. But all I'm saying is there's that extra cherry on top where there's a purpose that's higher than you that wants you to treat your woman because that's the right thing to do. And that's what God loves to see.
Tahani
is basically, it's pre-wedding. It's when you go and you take the, similar to you, you take the bride from her house, you get the parents' blessings, all of that.
On the same day?
Yeah. And that's done usually during the afternoon, right? Not during the evenings, during like afternoons, early mornings, late mornings. You do that and then you take the bride to a hall, and that hall is an open hall for all the people of the town or the village to come and say their congratulations. It's an open invitation. Ramadan is a month where you get closer with God. And people think that I'm going to get closer with God by just fasting. It's not really just fasting. You're not fasting from food and water. What you're fasting is from all the bad habits that you've had. And you're just
drunk. Yeah, I remember you did that back in yours as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess I'll just mention for our listeners. So hello and welcome to WS Podcast. Yet again, we're recording with Rami, a different setting. Same vibes.
Reunited,
and it's. I mean, a bit of a different time, and trying to just see where the conversation takes us as well.
Yeah.
Maybe let's kick it off just by mentioning you are right now in Ramadan.
Yeah.
Right. So I've not done a proper introduction of Ramadan for my listeners yet.
First of all, thank you for having me. It's great to be reunited again with you. Our last podcast was really, really, really nice. I enjoyed it. Most of my few listeners have enjoyed it for sure. Ramadan. So obviously now it's the holy month of Ramadan in Islam. Ramadan is a month where you get closer with God, and people think that I'm going to get closer with God by just fasting. It's not really just fasting. You're not fasting from food and water. What you're fasting is from all the bad habits that you've had, and you just try to get rid of them. Be it as simple as the bad habit of drinking coffee in the morning. If you feel like you want to quit drinking coffee, or if you feel like your body's dependent on something, then now is like the beautiful golden opportunity to kind of just wean off it and relax. And it also gives your body a chance to recover. So when you're always eating, your body's always busy trying to digest and take the nutrients and stuff like that. It does not have the time or the energy to clean the toxins out in your body. So Ramadan is also a chance for that. It's a chance for the Muslim brothers and sisters to connect with each other on a deeper level, on a more spiritual level. It's the month of kindness where you need to, give more than you receive. That's the appropriate way of saying things, for the sake of God. And so what we say, for the sake of Allah. Yeah, so we do it for the sake of God, because the way we look at it, right, is this world is a temporary phase, in your existence. And what we strive for as Muslims is the hereafter, which is a life that was promised to us after this life. We walk by the mentality of treating this life like a visitor. And Ramadan is kind of that month, that opportunity to do as much as you can for the hereafter.
Okay, so you're basically like amassing, you can supercharge your good journey.
Yeah, kind of detox as well from the bad one.
It might be very, very similar, if not basically the same, with different names for Advent, right? Because we are going for Advent in Christianity right now.
Oh, are you?
It's also Lent, I think, is the right word for it.
Yeah.
And it's also 40 days, so, you know.
Yeah, there are a few differences, I think, with that between Christianity and Islam. I think during Lent, I'm not too sure, correct me if I'm wrong, is it when you fast from animal products?
I think so. It might be, yeah.
Cool, yeah. So yeah, with Ramadan, it's you fast from everything.
Okay, so how about you? Because you mentioned, the bad habits and stuff, and for sure, like, I can definitely resonate with coffee having a big sort of grip, a strong grip on me. What is it for you? Where
do I start, man? I have so many bad habits. Starting with coffee in the morning, I can't get up without a cup of coffee. Black coffee, no sugar. I'm that type of guy, you know, I'm dark. And when I can't start without my morning coffee, but now it's kind of me learning how to get rid of that bad habit, especially because the purpose is higher than me. When you have a higher purpose than yourself, you kind of, that really, really, really pushes you to work towards it. At least that's how I look at it. So coffee's one. Two, what I'm bad for is snacking. I'm really, really, really bad for snacking. Especially when you're hungry.
But is it healthy snacking or is it...
No, it's bad snacking. Okay. I have a bad habit of just junk food.
Okay.
I have a kitchen and I know how to cook and I cook amazing food. But I'm also very, very, very lazy.
I think we all are, like, our most sort of expecting boss and our worst employee.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, well said, man. I think what we strive to do this month is basically get rid of all... That's just one of the things. It's just rid of all the bad habits. And it can be also, for me, it's cursing.
Okay.
Try to abstain from that as much as you can instead of saying the word F-U-C-K. Cursor. Do you know?
I wouldn't put you as a
no,
swearing
I do,
person.
I do. No, I have a bad habit of really like swearing, especially with my wife. And like in front of her, like when I talk, like I tend to like say F this and F that. And, you know, I use a lot of curse words. That's what I'm trying to say. Is that I use a lot of curse words in expression.
Yeah,
when I'm trying to express something, right? So I tried to abstain from that during that month, and that kind of teaches me.
You just amass them all, and then once it's over.
Yeah, but that's the thing, right? You're right. But that's the thing, right? That's not the point.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, fasting. Fasting is kind of giving you the opportunity to develop a discipline.
Yeah.
You know, and this research shows that people develop a discipline after 21 days.
Yeah, on average.
Exactly. So Ramadan is a month, so that can give me just a really, really good opportunity to reset, you know, and also kind of get closer with God. If I'm behind on my prayers, or if I'm like lazy trying to get closer with God, when it has to do with praying, or when it has to do with giving out to charity, or when it has to do with being kind or doing the right thing, that's the month where you need to kind of look at yourself more. You know, you should look at yourself always, but this is the month where it's like you really, really need to focus on these things and develop that habit during that month, because in that month, there's a higher purpose than all of us. So that when that month is over, that can kind of fix you in a way. You know,
just as a side note, I think intermittent fasting, just that is incredible, I think. And I actually mentioned on the podcast a few times before, I've been intermittent fasting basically for the past 2 years. Every day, and for me it's so incredible that as part of a religion, as part of a tradition, you have this ingrained, you know, which even if it was mimetic to begin with, maybe people didn't really analyze that this is gonna help us get healthier, you know, somehow this is what you're doing. And I think it's something that our consumption focused society certainly could use, you know. I wouldn't be surprised if doing this kind of fast for anyone, regardless of religion or anything, including other, you know, vices, could be of great benefit.
Oh, I agree 100%. And especially that I mentioned something over and over, is that having a higher purpose than you, more times than not, the driving factor for you, for most people, is when they hit rock bottom, is that they need to do something about their life. Islam kind of prevents you from hitting rock bottom and gets you to go like, okay, that's your chance now. Your reward in this life during that month is doubled. So there's always this higher purpose of, I'm not just doing this for myself, I'm doing this for, you know, for making the world a better place if I can, you know. Again, you should do that every month. You should strive to do that every month.
Every day, right.
But human beings relapse all the time. Whether it has to do with, you know, from the simplest things all the way to the most hardcore stuff. So, yeah, that month, I'm trying to take that opportunity and remind myself, that's your chance. This month is your chance.
Do you, are there any sort of, you know, suggestions, or do you also within that month maybe limit your consumption of stimuli? I mean, like, you know, for example, I bet, I am certain that what we watch, what we eat, what we consume in all senses impacts our experience, right? And like, if this is a month where you're supposed to self-reflect more, be a bit more self-aware, do you also maybe take less time on social media? I don't know, not watch as many random movies on Netflix as part of
it. No, 100%. This is what I mean by detox as well. It's not just detox physically, it's also the spiritual aspect where you need to detox. You start catching yourself during the month of Ramadan when it comes to, for example, scrolling, right? You start going like, oh, like that's the month where I should be reading the Quran, or that's the month where I should be like praying more. So that indirectly kind of gets you away from these kind of stimuluses, right? And pushes you to be a better person, you know?
So how does it, you know, on average, let's say your average day usually versus your average day during Ramadan, what are the major differences? Apart from, you mentioned coffee, trying not to snack, not to swear. Is there a different pattern to your day?
Yeah, 100%, man. You know, with Muslims, they should pray, the first prayer during the day is usually early morning.
Like 5 o'clock or
like
something.
Like almost, it's when the sun rises.
Yeah, right.
Or before the sun rises, just before the sun rises. And human beings, like if you even go back in time, that's when human beings started, like woke up and started to, you know, go about their day and hunt and, you know. So
Islam, of course, they didn't have light, like apart from a fire maybe, so.
Exactly. So with Islam, because you have these five prayers during the month of Ramadan, I remind myself, because I tend to slack, and it's wrong to slack on the prayers, Islamically speaking.
Okay.
So with the month of Ramadan, because I want to become a better person, I go like, no, I'm going to wake up at 5 a.m. And what that does is that it regulates my entire day. It gives my day a schedule, right? 5 o'clock, I've got a prayer. 12 o'clock, I've got a prayer. 4 o'clock, I've got a prayer. 3 o'clock, I've got a prayer. And then I've got a prayer at 5. It's 5. So 3 o'clock and then 5:40, 5:45.
Okay.
And then at 7. So by the time it's 7 o'clock, it's already nighttime. You're not supposed to be awake.
Yeah, of course.
Your body now is starting to secrete melatonin. And that's when your body's telling you, hey, time to go to bed. It regulates your clock.
Mm.
So with the month of Ramadan, that's also something that kind of, I go like, okay, I need to now stick more to my prayers. I need to be more disciplined with my prayers. And that indirectly regulates my day.
But okay, so I know for sure that you've been, there is also a part of not eating throughout the day, right?
Yeah.
While the sun is up. So how does that all connect? Like, do you just end up staying half of the night as well?
So it's different for different people. The Prophet, peace be upon him, has advised on having something called suhoor. Suhoor is basically waking up before the sun rises and having something to eat.
Okay, and before then, you start the day.
Yep, and then
oh, wow, okay.
As soon as the prayer time hits, when the sun's about to rise, when the prayer time hits, you pray, and then you go about your day, right?
Okay.
So basically, you can do it that way. Uh-huh. You can, that way you're eating twice, technically, a day. Or you can be like me, which is a little bit more hardcore. It's not really advisable. It's eating once every 24 hours.
I think that's great.
And that's fine.
Like, for
that's
some time, I'm pretty sure you can that, get exactly away with that.
Even that is fine, right? Also, physiologically speaking, when your body hits the 12 to 16 hour mark, it recognizes that, okay, this guy is not going to feed us. Now we're going to undergo something called ketosis, which is just a fancy way of saying, well, we have no reserve, we have no carbs to turn into glucose and sugar and, you know, function. So now we're going to rely on the body's sources that he's already stored, which is fat. And it takes that from the liver or it takes that from other parts. I'm not too educated on that.
No, you're doing great. I think that's the essence for sure.
So that's what, exactly. So that's what happens. And, you know, you stop feeling at some point during Ramadan, you stop feeling hungry.
Mm.
You stop asking for food. Your body stops asking you. Why? Because you've disciplined your body. Your mind was stronger than your body and you told your body, hey, shut up. I'm not going to listen to you.
Mm.
and then you become in control. So your body stops asking you for food, which is crazy. And then by the time iftar comes, iftar meaning, for the people who are listening who don't know what iftar means, just time to break your fast. When iftar time comes, you have the way the Prophet did it is he had 3 dates and he had a glass of water and okay. he prayed. And then after he prayed, he had his meal. But you know what I found? It's crazy that that was done 1500 years ago, 1400 years ago. When I do that now, when I have 3 dates and I have a glass of water, I'm full. I'm not even hungry. Your stomach with time in Ramadan shrinks. It stops really asking for much. Yeah. It only asks for what it needs. You know, and you can kind of listen to your body and know you can kind of, these cravings that you go, oh, I feel like bread. I feel like a cookie. What you're really craving is carb, sugar, right? And because your stomach shrinks, you don't really ask, your body doesn't demand much of you.
Yeah.
So I can go on and on with the benefits of Ramadan.
Oh man, but even to extend it further, the incredible thing about it is, I don't know how much further have you gone, like how many days have you tried fasting, but I've gone as far as I think 5.5 days. You know, fasting, literally just water and some basic minerals to keep myself up.
Oh, really?
And it's completely, like, it's a full-on detox and it's okay. Like, you can literally do it because you're burning, as you said. On ketosis, you have just a steady level, burning. Because it's basically what we would have gone through being in the wild, hunting, being cold, right? When there are no fruits, it's winter. And you need to maybe wait a day, 2 days, 3 days before you get that next meal properly.
Yeah.
So on this point, I'm certain that the benefits are endless. And for example, now there are studies. I actually participated in a 3-day retreat, which was about like cold exposure. So basically, you know, going into ice cold water, meditating in the snow, going to breathing outside and stuff. And also we did not eat throughout the whole trip. So my mom was joking that what am I paying for, right? but they've done studies and there's plenty of it now out there for you guys to look into that if you have cancer, what ketosis and autophagy does. Autophagy is this
autophagy is the cells eating your toxic cells. Yep.
Exactly. And basically what they found is if you have like cancer, of course, this is not, you know, medical advice, whatever, but like apparently the first cells that get eaten are usually the broken ones. So you can really positively impact your remission, your fight with the cancer by just not feeding it any food. Because if you think about it, it's like a parasite that is sucking your life energy. But if you don't take any energy in and that energy is just stored within you, then the parasite will have to, you know, sort of starve with you.
Yeah.
And it's not having ketosis itself.
Yeah. Do you know what?
So it's incredible.
A few days ago, I had a conference North Queensferry. And when I got there, I didn't sleep well the night before. That was a few days ago. That was over the weekend on a Friday. And I didn't really sleep well the previous night because I ate too much. And then I woke up and I wasn't really like, I was like feeling really, really drowsy. I didn't sleep well and stuff like that. So I went to that conference or that course and I sat there and I was sleepy. I was yawning a lot and stuff and I was fasting. You know, it's not really the best feeling. And you see everyone and everyone's really like energized and stuff, and then you walk in and you smell. See, when you're fasting, all of your senses are really heightened.
Yeah.
I walk in and I smell coffee, that fresh brew of coffee, exactly how I like it.
Mm.
And now I was like going, do I really have to fast? What is this bullshit? All of that things, you know, all of these, I was saying all of these things in my head.
Yeah.
And then I paused there for a second and I was like, hold on a minute. These are like, I'm defeating myself here. These are minor defeats that I'm just giving myself. It's not about the coffee and it's not about the food that was there. It was all delicious. It looked delicious. It smelled delicious. But if I, I said to myself, if I eat, that will define who I am. And that's maybe an overkill or over-exaggeration on how I am defining the situation. But I told myself, if I eat, I lose the battle between myself and I, because I have given in to my desire to want to eat that delicious, you know, they had delicious pastries in the morning and this, you know, black coffee that was there, and everyone, you could hear people pouring that cup of coffee from that, you know, thermos, and I can hear it just go down that cup, and I was hearing and smelling everything, and it shed a light on how weak I am, you know. And I said to myself, if I was going to give in right now, then I am a weak person. I'm a weak-minded person. Mm. If I'm giving up just because I crave coffee, then this is me being lazy when I'm practicing my faith.
Yeah, but I mean, this
is... borderline hypocrite.
Yeah, but this is something that everyone is experiencing at all times, right? Like Brené Brown has this amazing quote, which I actually mentioned recently in a conversation, funnily enough. Every action you take is a vote for the kind of person you wish to become. And we're having those like situations, cravings, regardless of fast or any other special occasion, all of the time. And we are either on an upward or a downward, you know, energetically, spiritually, whatever you want to call it, journey in those moments, right? Like if you give in to your lower self because you crave that cookie and you didn't want to eat it, then you just sort of, you allowed this wolf, some people call it, you know, rather than the other, or this lower self rather than a higher self, to win that battle. And it's like a tiny battle, tiny battle, tiny battle, and suddenly you find yourself, you know, under the table.
Yeah, do you know what's funny, man? It's what's really, really funny, and I think I need to say this, the year before, I had that exact scenario, and that I was exposed to that circumstance and that scenario, where something, where, you know, we were out and I was with a bunch of my friends and things like that, and there was delicious food and coffee and things like that, and I had the same, oh man, this is like, do I have to fast? I'm not gonna fast. So I broke my fast, right? And the moment I broke my fast, disappointingly, it's not the I broke my fast part, it's more of, when I had the first sip of coffee, I was like, was that it?
Yeah.
It was not worth it. It wasn't worth it. So that's what disappointed me so much, is that that really was not worth it. And I could have gone by, and it's that feeling of defeat the whole day.
Yeah, of course.
Mental defeat.
It's the same thing, you know, obviously you don't smoke tobacco, right?
No.
I struggled with tobacco for a long time, especially sort of, when you come back to it after whatever, I don't remember. Essentially, I quit and I managed to go for some time, but I didn't actually defeat that inner, you know, craving, let's say, the lower self craving. I wasn't strong enough, I guess. And I succumbed to smoke again. And as you say, like, and I bet everyone out there who is struggling with some sort of addiction will say the same. Like, your imaginary sensation that you're anticipating, ends up being much better than the reward itself. And you just feel really, really defeated. You know, so many people fall back into smoking cigarettes because they feel, I believe... they actually feel so defeated after that time that for some time they just completely give up, you know? Because what is one cigarette, right? If you're addicted, one cigarette is huge, unless you don't smoke the second one. Because you've just, you know, let's say that you've not smoked for a year, you smoke once, and if that was the only cigarette, it will take you some time to say that you've not smoked for a year, but I'm pretty sure the biggest challenge is then the next day not being like, I fucked up already, so I might as well, you know? And you throw up your hands in the air and another 10 years passed before, you know.
Yeah, man, it's also like...
It's an inner battle.
Yeah, and we circle back to disciplining yourself. You know, it's disciplining these desires. These desires are... People think that these desires go away. These desires never go away. Mm. You know, when anything, it has to come with smoking weed or smoking cigarettes or whatever it is that it has to be. these desires never go away, and you need to always keep yourself in check and discipline that self, because your soul, your body always wants you to do not the best thing for it.
Yeah.
And that's what Islam says, is that your self always orders you to do something that's not good for you. And just because you feel a certain way about a certain situation, or you feel like you want to do something, or you feel like this and feel like that, doesn't mean that you should go for it always. You should always check yourself and see whether that is the right thing to do. And Islam and keeps you in check, you know. And Ramadan, especially Ramadan, it's times two, times three, times four. And you're always mindful, you're always checking yourself, you're always disciplining yourself. And it's not easy. It's not easy. It's not just the water and food is easy. It's not about the water and food. It's about keeping yourself in check always on every level, right? And how you treat people, how you control your anger, how you, you know, feel like saying something, and sometimes you say it when you're not supposed to say it. You know, you always check yourself. You go like, I'm fasting, you know, I should, you know. And that over time teaches you the habit of, when you're not fasting, you go like, I've done this when I was fasting, why can't I do it now? You know?
It's interesting as well that, you know, it comes up at the beginning of the year, in also, from my perspective, in the time where, for example, here in Edinburgh, you know, we've been in the winter stage for a few months now, right? So it's a very challenging time to... People make all those New Year resolutions and whatnot, but essentially, like, you know, as you said, it's basically everyday battle. If you can make it in this time, I think it will be much easier to continue it going forwards, because in a moment's time we're gonna have spring, and just, you know, unless you're living in the Middle East where the sun is up, you know, just the sun being up so long makes such a difference, right?
And you know, with disciplining yourself is a skill that you need to practice on. Take for example, when we talk about training anything, jiu-jitsu, or even training bicep curls, you know, or let's talk jiu-jitsu. The first time you do a straight leg lock, let's say, because I like to do it. The first time you do a straight leg lock, attempting, you're going to struggle to do a leg lock for quite some time, right? You're going to struggle. Your technique's going to be bad. You're not going to know how to, or when to tuck your elbow in, and when to, you know, yank the foot, or, you know, you're always going to try until you develop that skill. Sorry.
That's okay. That's okay.
Until you develop that skill to do that sort of thing. And similarly with fasting, when you abstain from something, let's say food, after Ramadan you teach yourself the skill of not eating for so long. You teach yourself that skill, and then it's second nature to you.
I mean, you develop that muscle, right? It's muscle memory.
100%.
To begin with. And in the same way, having, I think, just to circle back to that prayer times, I think that structure is also something that, unless you're a structured kind of person, you know, that you by default have a certain structure, it's a great opportunity to develop at least, I would say, a minimum, the morning and the evening routines that are for your benefit, whatever that means to you. You know, it doesn't have to be work, because work is usually in the middle, unless you're working, you know, nighttime. But having that structure and then sticking to it, that's how you develop that muscle, right?
Yeah.
And then over time, it just becomes a second nature. I mean, by now, the moment you're in a certain position around the leg, your body will just do a
You won't even think
lock,
twice.
You know? Yeah.
You won't think twice about it, man.
It's like with language, with anything, really, with any skill.
Yeah. So, the Ramadan is countless, really countless benefits that come from it.
So what do you think, because you mentioned that last year it's been more difficult for you, or maybe, you know, you sort of erred more. Is there anything in particular that changed over the year that you think, you know, have you been trying to develop some habits throughout the year to prepare for it? Or is it just a matter of growing up and being a bit more...
preparing for fasting, you mean?
I mean, just being disciplined, you know, because you mentioned that last year you had that urge to drink coffee and you went for it, and this year you didn't. So, you know, is there anything in particular that you would blame for this change for the better?
Not really. It's just again, the body or the yourself always wants things that are not the best for it, and it's always going to be there. And you need to constantly discipline that. You know, just because I overcame that now doesn't mean that it might not come again in the future. And I can't live in fear knowing that I'm going, or in weakness knowing that I'm going to get that craving again, whatever it is. We're talking about on a small scale, we're talking coffee, right? But it's, it could be other things for other people, okay? Mm-hmm. So I can't live in the fear of, or the that weakness or that idea that, oh my God, I'm going to get that feeling again and I don't know how I'm going to act. No, you're going to get that feeling again, and that's extremely normal. And that's why you need to constantly be disciplining yourself, you know? Just like with a child. You're not going to discipline your kid once, twice, three times, five times, 10 times, 15 times, and they might still do the same mistake. So you need to be a parent to them, just like you need to be a parent to yourself.
Mm.
And that's how I look at it.
Yeah,
and
no.
It's not easy, and you will fail.
It's everyday stuff, like literally with everything. I think it's a... it's an upward spiral if you let it, if you keep doing the right choices, keep making more right choices than wrong, let's say.
And the more important thing is that you're going to be, I'm not saying that it's going, when it comes, you're always going to be at that level of weakness. No, you're definitely, every time that feeling or that desire comes, you're going to be more well-rounded, more experienced in that scenario when it comes to drinking coffee.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be experienced because you failed before. You've experienced the hardest of cravings and the lowest of cravings. You've experienced all of that. You become experienced in that hardship.
Mm-hmm.
So every time you get that, when that feeling comes again, and then you discipline yourself, and then it comes again, it does get easier. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to ever show up again. It's always going to show up, whether it's coffee or anything else.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, you sort of mentioned kids, so unless you don't want to talk about it. We owe my listeners a chance to hear about both, you know, arranging, or maybe how would you think of arranging your upcoming marriage and the wedding. And I don't know, we can sort of just vibe on that as well.
Oh, yeah. We've had the wedding. Super with excited. Yeah. Well, so for the listeners, I'm technically not, I'm married now, but we're doing the wedding ceremony in August of this year. And, you know, for cultural reasons and all of that, which is why we're doing it. My wife and I don't really, we were just happy getting married in a mosque, and, you know, it's not really.
So when did that happen?
That happened on October 25th of 2025.
Oh, wow. So literally a week after mine. That's amazing.
Yeah, you keep telling
such
me that.
Such a quick turnaround.
Yeah.
Because you've proposed, what, in August?
August.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. There's no point in waiting, right?
So, of course. With her being able to move. Yeah.
So we're kind of, right now we're in the, I actually booked my flights today. To go, like, I booked my flights 3 weeks in advance of the wedding to prepare. And
for 3 weeks, you're going there to prepare.
Yeah. Arab weddings are, you know, a big deal. They're like massive.
Tell me.
So,
what are you anticipating?
The music, the DJs, the hall. You have to rent a car and drive around town in a convertible. It's like a thing where you like beep the horns, and people, like your friends, all ride in the cars and they're behind you and they beep the horns and.
Oh, wow.
And that, like, that's that. Yeah, you need to, like, find a car to rent. You need to find the hall. You need to find hotel rooms to stay in, you know, after the wedding night. You need to book your flights, obviously.
Yeah.
You need to talk with the DJs. You need to, you know, to for the music, what kind of music. We need to go and rehearse our dance. We need to go and...
you mean the first dance?
Yeah.
Or you don't have something like similar to Indian weddings that there is a stage and you...
Oh, no.
It's the first dance.
The first dance,
and then everyone
joins and dances. So we need to practice our dance. We need to be there before time. And then there's another like squad where they dance Lebanese traditional dancing. So we need to talk to them and kind of arrange how that's going to happen.
Nice.
The flowers, the food, the list goes on and on. I can literally... go on and on, excuse me.
Are you in charge of organizing all? Or
luckily, I'm so blessed to have my dad support me during this time. You know, he's like, don't worry, I'm going to help you. You know, when it comes to the finance of things, when it comes to the or, like organizing things. Mm. Also, I forgot, you need to, traditionally, you need to buy her gold of her choosing, you know, whatever she chooses to go, like she wants like necklace, or she wants a set, you know, like a bracelet, earrings, necklace, ring. You need to go buy her that of her choosing, and she needs to choose that. So I need to go with her, and we need to go and pick out gold for her. So it's a whole thing. That, so I even believe 3 weeks is not enough time. Oh, we need to go.
But you're organizing everything within 3 weeks.
Yeah. No. We're organizing things from now.
Okay. Okay.
But by the time we get there, we want things to be bish, bash,
wash.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Done.
Of course. Yeah. Right? No. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. So we're kind of preparing for that at the moment, and it's so overwhelming. You know, we're
going
to be...
When are you going?
I'm going on July, 24th of July.
Okay. So you still have a bit of time.
Yeah, around 5 months' time.
Wow.
So it is overwhelming, man.
Is there any... So for context, dependent on a family tradition and also how religious a family in Poland is, one of the things that we did because of my mother-in-law was there is a tradition of... as a groom, need to come and pick up my bride from her parents' house, and I need to get their blessing. We need to get their blessing, and then we go to whatever the ceremony place. And then when we're going into the place where we're going to be celebrating, there is a certain sort of even a speech, as like a scenario, a script of what you say as you walk in through the door. They welcome you with bread and salt, and then they give you, one of us got a glass of vodka and one of us got a glass of water, and that was like whoever gets the vodka is the one who's gonna be in charge of the family. And then you take a swig, and then you throw it behind you to shatter as part of like for good blessing, whatever. So do you have any of those intricate like little, you know?
Not really. I don't think we have that. But we have something called tahani. Tahani is basically, it's pre-wedding. It's when you go and you take the, similar to you take the bride from her house, you get the parents' blessings, all of that.
On the same day?
Yeah. And that's done usually during the afternoon, right? Not during the evenings, yeah. During like afternoons, early mornings, late mornings. You do that, and then you take the bride to a hall, and that hall is an open hall for all the people of the town or the village to come and say their congratulations. It's an open invitation. And they walk in, and you know, they shake the hands of the people there, her family, my family, her friends, my friends, you know, cousins.
So relatives. Who are they congratulating? Not only
us.
You. But also your parents and your... Wow,
yeah, so
okay.
People of the whole village, they must know that these two got married. So that is an open invitation to everyone. The doors are open for like a few hours. So people come and go, come and go, come and go. They sit for like 5 minutes and then they say their congratulations and they leave. And they're just a bunch of chairs. And they get, when they're walking out, they get like sweets as a thank you for coming.
Do they bring gifts at that point as well? Or is that
not
a
necessarily
different part? Okay.
The gifts come if you are technically invited to the wedding.
Okay, I see.
The wedding, which happens in the evening, is people, selected people that are invited. You know, you have to have a certain number of... You need to know who's coming because you're booking them in, because you need to pay for these people, you know.
Yeah, for food and
everything. For food and everything. And yeah, so basically, the people that come with gifts are usually the people that are invited. Or even people that are not invited who wish to support, there's like a box... Mm-hmm. Where you can just slide in money.
Oh, yeah.
For the newlyweds.
In so, that tahini?
Tahani. Tahani. So tahani means greetings. Where they just say their greetings. Hello, congratulations. They can slide in money if they want, or if they don't. That's
how many hours do you anticipate that?
It's a full day. Literally a full day.
Tahani is a full day.
Tahani is like a couple of hours, maybe 3 to 4
yeah.
hours. And then the wedding is, you know, it's
yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
but it usually starts in the evening then.
Yeah. Nighttime usually. That's when our parties start. You know?
But is it usual in Muslim weddings that you actually get married in a mosque, regardless, on a different date, and then all the celebration happens?
So my wife and I, we are Muslim. Our families aren't. So
okay.
We're having a traditional wedding with the family.
Oh.
We already got married. we already, like, religiously speaking, in front of God, we're already married.
Yeah.
But we have to do this ritual thing, or this thing, culturally speaking, where, you know, every married couple should do. Even if it's non, even if it's Muslim. Muslim mm-hmm. people do religious wedding first.
Okay.
And then they do the party.
But do they usually do it on the same day then?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily. They can do the religious wedding first, so that the bride and the groom can go out together, they can speak with each other, you know, they, you know, can go out in public and say, we're married, basically, mm-hmm. right? And then the whenever the party is, it's just, it's irrelevant.
So, you caught me off guard there. If I may ask, what happened that you and your wife are Muslim and your family isn't? How did that come about?
That's a long-ass story, bro. Like, my parents, me,
growing up... Is that usual?
You see it. It's not common, yeah. right? But it is becoming more common now that people are really knowing what Islam is and what Islam stands for, and, you know that image that Islam was given. People are now coming to terms of knowing that that's not true. So my wife and I, we were never really convinced of our family's religions, right?
What are those?
It's called Druze.
Okay.
D-R-U-Z, which is really a sect Druze. Of Islam. It okay. comes from a sect of Shia. Shias. It's even a sect of Shias. So, and we are a minority. You know, that's a minority, which I was not really fully on board with. So I had this journey of trying to find religion and stuff, and Islam really resonated with me. I've tried everything. And Islam really,
since when do you maybe we've covered it on the
yeah we did show, I think we did sure. we did talk about it
when
yeah.
when did you
I think probably around COVID time.
Okay, wow. Yeah,
2021.
So it's a fully conscious decision. Oh, that's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, 100%, yeah.
I think this is really not unusual, but maybe, as you said, uncommon. Because, you know, from my perspective, it's usually the religion is being pushed on you by your family even before you know what religion is, right?
Yeah, or even
and,
to this
and
day.
And you just get used to it and
even to this
so
day.
Be it.
Yeah, even to this day, you know, and it doesn't really matter if, you know, before I used to want to get the acceptance of my family, now not so much.
Mm.
Because no matter how much you try to explain why you follow what you follow, or, you know, why you believe in something the way you do, you're never going to really convince someone, you know, or get someone to really, they can understand you, but they can, mm-hmm. they can't really feel, unless they've experienced the same things that you have, maybe then they can relate, you know, or maybe they've connected with God, Islamically speaking, on the same spiritual level, Islamically, then they can relate. Otherwise, you can tell someone all you want what it feels like to be Muslim, or, you know, what is Islam. But if they don't have it in them to really want to be, or want to really explore, then they're never really going to explore or really going to agree with you. And that's fine.
Yeah.
And that's completely fine. And I've come to terms with that, you know? But at the end of the day, I want to be happy and I want to follow what I want to follow. And, my wife feels the same way.
She also found it, later in life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Same thing. Yeah. So we... And mind you, maybe I have had an influence on her. Maybe I don't want to lie to myself and say that I haven't. I have introduced her to the religion more and more, but I've never, never forced her onto anything.
Mm.
She was always curious. She would always ask me questions. She would always like be like, why would you do this? Or why would you think that way? Why would you do that a certain way? And why would you like wash every time you pray? Or why would you pray that way? Or why won't you eat pork? Or why won't you this? And I would explain things to her. And not force anything, because I've learned from my mistakes before in the past. And I would never force anything onto her. And one day she just... Actually, she was the one that told me, like, let's get married in a mosque. She was the one that proposed it. And it was always in my head. I always wanted to do it. But I didn't want to ask her that, because I didn't want it to come off as I'm forcing her into anything.
Mm-hmm.
And one day she just, you know, she told me I'm going to pray. And fast forward a few, you know, months later, she was like, why don't we get married in a mosque? And I told her, this is something that I've always wanted to talk to you about, and I'm glad you asked me that, because I've always wanted to do that. So yes, and yeah, we got married in a mosque. And
that's incredible. And did you invite anyone to that part?
Two of my friends.
Okay.
You need witnesses.
Of course.
You need
yeah,
witnesses. You need her consent. You know, you need to bring something as an offering, you know, like dates or whatever to the mosque, you know. Also, she has what's called a mahr. A mahr is just something that she can ask for. It can be anything she wants, you know. It's an offering to her.
Okay.
If she says, yes, we can get married, but my proposition or my want or my need or my term is I want, let's say, £5,000. You know, if you can do that, you can say, okay, sure. If you can't, you can't like argue with her or like try to bring the price
down. There's no bargaining.
You can't bargain. You can't bargain.
There is no bargaining with wives anyway,
no,
I think.
No, you can't bargain with her because she's not a product. Like she's not.
Yeah,
she's not an item, you know. That's what she would like, and you have to agree if you really want this person. Uh-huh. Usually 9 times out of 10, the woman would be righteous, and that's when you know that the woman's righteous, and she wouldn't care about asking for anything.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
I mean, it's also a good sign for you going literally forward, right? Like if a deal breaker is £10,000, then I don't know if you want to be.
Then it would raise a lot of questions. It would raise a lot of questions. But she literally said like she wants a Quran and she doesn't really care and all about that. And that brought me really reassurance.
Have you had those discussions before you proposed?
Yeah, 100%. Wow. I had to let her know these are your rights.
I see. So those are the steps. Yes. Oh, okay.
I'm just giving you like
a shortcut. That's great, man. Like,
yeah, 100%. She has to know her rights. She has to consent, obviously.
Yeah.
In normal circumstances in Islam, her father should also consent.
Mm-hmm.
Given that he's not Muslim, the imam of the masjid becomes her guardian.
Okay.
And he can consent on her behalf as well, and she can consent if she allows him. So she also has to consent that he has to ask her, can I be your guardian for this marriage or proposal? And she can either say yes or no. So these are things like tiny details that she has to know,
mm-hmm,
before getting married. And yeah, it's Islam has made it so simple, religiously speaking, to get married, because it wants to prevent adultery. It wants to prevent, you know, sexual intimacy out of marriage. It just wants to make things easy for people.
Mm.
Getting married was so easy for us. It was so easy, thank God. And I'm so blessed.
So will you have any sort of ritual marriage, whatever thing, some sort of ceremony during your
traditional? That's in August. So we're just having a party. In August.
But will you actually do any sort of, you know, standing next to one another and agreeing that you will get married or whatever?
Culturally.
Okay.
Just for cultural purposes.
Yeah.
But between me, her and God, we are married.
Yeah, no, of course.
Do you know what I mean? And we don't need, like, that for
and
us.
And I bet it's legally binding as well, right?
No. So a religious marriage, even if you go to church and you get married, the relationship that you, her and God have is you are married. Religiously speaking, you are married. You then take that marriage certificate and you go to your council.
Okay.
Or you go to the court or you go somewhere and you make it legal.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So in Poland, it's actually prearranged that, you know, the document is being sourced, I guess, through the church. So the church is legally binding because it's basically the document is just there.
That's better. You know, that makes it easier as well.
You don't have to take it anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. So for us, after you get married in a mosque, you need to go and legally, you know, in court or in
a
council.
Where did you go in Edinburgh?
So we're going to do it in Lebanon.
Oh,
we're
going
to make it legal in Lebanon because the paperwork is easier.
Okay.
Yeah. So between me, her and God, we're married and she has, that way she is more reassured that I have a duty as a husband now and not just some boyfriend, right?
Mm.
And or some, you know, nothing, not like
candidate.
There's something wrong with that though. No, if that works for you, that works for you. That's not what I'm saying. But for me, in order to give her that reassurance, getting married was part of it, a huge part of it.
How are you feeling?
Amazing, man. Amazing. It keeps me in check.
Mm.
Keeps me in check, bro.
I think we sort of it's like yet another reason to work on yourself more.
100%. Also, remember,
something to sort of,
I'm also getting married. I'm treating this woman, when I treat with this woman, I'm treating this woman with how God wants me to treat this woman. There's this higher power. Not that you shouldn't treat your woman in a good way anyway. No, you should. You must treat your woman in a good way. But all I'm saying is there's that extra cherry on top where there's a purpose that's higher than you that wants you to treat your woman because that's the right thing to do. And that's what God loves to see. And it's treating your woman right, giving her her rights, yada, yada, yada.
You're kind of accountable to three parties now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So to me, that's what makes me comfortable. That's not to say that, you know, people that are not married are not doing things right. I'm in no place to say that, right?
Yeah.
For me personally, that's what works for me. That just to make that, like,
yeah, no,
clear.
If anything, you know, my perspective, and I actually recorded an episode to explain, sort of to break down my perspective of why did I get married in the first place. But it's
right. Why did you get married?
I mean, you know, because I want to be with Julia and have a family with her. But
you can do that out, like, without being married. So what was it for you?
Exactly, yeah. So I believe that it it adds a layer of commitment that is, apart from the legal part, just sort of ritually, spiritually, let's say, it adds a layer of commitment to the relationship that literally it's sort of opens a new paradigm. I feel the biggest change in the perception of a relationship is that commitment that now we're in this together. We're actually together. You know, we're no longer kind of, oh, maybe we'll walk some part of life and then, I don't know. As you said, it sort of becomes a free person relationship.
Partnership.
And
yeah,
whether you call it God or, you know, however you want to put it, I do believe it adds to the depth of our life together, and also it makes many things much easier as well. And I, you know, this is just from a societal standpoint. It actually seems to me that, you know, I'm pretty sure many people are quite lost these days, thinking that marriage is something that takes away from you and stuff. But even in societal everyday life, I'm seeing only benefits of these. You know.
Yeah. Imagine having a kid as well, like. Your kid subconsciously knowing that my parents are married just gives that kid a sense of security.
It's like a stronger foundation.
Yeah,
exactly.
And that kid seeing other people with kids, or seeing other kids that whose parents are not married, right? Not that, you know, they're gonna get separated or not. No, I know people that have been together for 20 years, 30 years, you know, and no problem.
Oh, yeah.
But that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that it could also add to the kid a sense of security, a sense of, you know, a stable household.
Yeah, certainly.
Does that make sense?
I mean, you know, coming back to the same idea, if we're walking together and the going gets hard, if it's very easy, basically no, there are no losses to be had if we split, because we are not legally bound, we are not spiritually bound, we don't have, you know, whatever. It becomes much easier for us to fall off the wagon if we, you know, succumb to some difficulty of life.
Yeah, beautifully
right?
said, yeah. Beautifully said, yeah.
And it seems to me that when we got married, it's kind of like now we jump into a wagon together. And we're still going in a direction, and every now and then, you know, we might be, you know, pulling and pushing, and there might be some cobblestones around, but it's much more difficult. There is a huge opportunity cost to suddenly, you know, breaking up the marriage. Of course, you can have all the legalities and stuff that basically, like, you know, they cannot take anything from you and whatnot. If people want to do it, fair play. But for me, you know, on so many levels, including spiritually, that's that, you know, now we're in this together. We're having trouble. Well, we're going to have to go through it, right? Whereas I feel like many people these days, especially those that are not maybe interested in getting married because they feel like the commitment is too great. I would say check yourself, why are you so scared of commitment? Because that's coming back to the discipline and all that. Like, does that mean you're scared of doing, trying to make yourself better and doing a certain set of activities?
But you know what also, man?
Each day for your life?
To be fair, because we also have to shine a light on the other side of the coin, which is the judicial system here, at least in the UK or maybe even in the US, penalizes you for getting married. Especially the man, you know? And I know someone that's
current. How come? What do you mean?
Because, you know, if you get a divorce, she gets half your stuff. Basically. Okay. And that...
Yeah, but how...
Men now...
Wait, but how is that penalizing? Like, that's basically... I guess that's assuming that you have all the stuff and the wife doesn't.
No.
That she gets half the stuff. Because if she gets half the stuff, but by default, by being married, half is hers, then that, there's no penalty there, I feel.
So, if you are a working man and your wife is like, stay at home and
I see.
You're okay. Working your entire life, and let's say you break up for whatever reason, you get a divorce, you have to give up half your wealth, literally half your wealth. And that's just not right, man. Now, men are going to go like, men now are going like, I don't need this bullshit.
But think about it this way. How many couples out there actually do have that where there is only one person working? Maybe that's going to be the case for you, but like, I am certain that apart from the whole, you know, spiritual, what we bring to the family and also the great work that women do if they are, you know, at home, I think. I'm pretty sure majority of people these days are working both, you know, both sides are working.
Yeah.
And even if one is a greater breadwinner than the other, I mean, I understand how it might disincentivize the marriage. But at the same time, I feel like maybe we're giving too much focus to that. And it's sort of preparing yourself to fail.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if I were to assume that whatever I'm doing in my life, if I fuck up, for the lack of a better word, I will be penalized, which is true. That's essentially what happens in life. You're playing a game, and if you're doing correct, if you're going correctly, you're doing great. And if you're not going correctly, at some point it might get a bit difficult, and maybe really punish you, kind of slap you in the face. It seems to me that if we're establishing a goal is to be together, to make life together, to make family together, if you have such an aspiration, right? If I'm from that standpoint, if I'm calculating that if I fail in this, I will have to give up half of what I've earned over this period, which is, by the way, taken away by your taxes on the daily, why am I focusing so much on that I'm not willing to take the chance? It's like coming up to a jiu-jitsu fight, and because you know that you might lose and feel the sensation of defeat, you've not tried. And you miss on the greatest opportunity, I believe, spiritually, of your life, of making a family. I mean, you can make a family without a family, but you're basically screwing up everyone.
Maybe it's not just only that. It's maybe we're going off topic a little bit, but maybe because also men don't believe that they can, maybe, I don't know, find someone to be a wife.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
I think this is a malaise of our time in both
directions. It could be, directions. Yeah. Both directions, men and women. Yeah. Obviously, women feel the same way. Is that men, you know, can't be husbands and women can't be wives?
You know, we sort of touched on it once, I believe, either on the previous podcast or maybe as we were chatting before the podcast, that I sort of feel that the most important thing for you to have a good quality relationship is to first and foremost for you to work on you. And once you get a certain level of clarity about how does it, what does it mean for you to be a good you, and the wife will appear or the girlfriend will appear, and then you're, you know, the opportunity might be met with more skill, right? And I believe that in media these days, and maybe the trend is changing, hopefully, I've talked on the show before about like toxic masculinity and the divide that is being driven by media saying like you can be an independent man, you can be an independent woman, you know, you'll be so happy and successful in a career, which is proven to be actually after a certain age, many women, majority of them decide, I want to have kids, but now I've committed the part of my fertile life to work and I cannot. So all of these aspects, I'm kind of jumping around, from my perspective, point to the fact that we're so obsessed about the expectations of how the other should be and how the experience should be. And we are so not humble to work on ourselves daily with those little habits that then we are, you know, met. There is a frustrated man and a frustrated woman. He expects her to be better. She expects him to be better. Neither of them is willing to do the work on themselves to become better. And then they are surprised that, you know, many years pass and they are still alone. And with each year, they come talking about those steps. With each year, they get more and more self-assured that it's the world out there that is not allowing me to have the love of my life, because they've been choosing again and again to think that way.
Yeah. For me personally, and that's just my personal opinion, in order for the marriage to be successful long term, you know, you need to have some sort of, but I'm just speaking for myself here, myself and my wife, you need to have some sort of higher purpose, right? And you need to have a reference to go back to. And you need to have that reference is always the correct reference, so that when you guys get in conflict, you know how to solve that conflict, because you have that higher power, that higher, you know, purpose to get back to and know what the right thing is to do, right? Like a manual to go back to and go like, okay, I'm sorry I was wrong here, or hey, I'm sorry I was wrong here, or it just is a more stable marriage long term. And the reason why we have so many divorces now is because, in my opinion, people have strayed away from God.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, whatever God means to them, but
yes,
I 100%. I think in this we're fully in agreement. I think many, and this is probably you're a testament, and your wife are a testament to how we've gone so far off that we're coming back, that even our parents are not, you know, with this faith, with this religion, and for the benefit of your life improving, you found this for yourself.
Yeah,
for sure. I think people are, yet again, about those habits and consumption, we're so lost, so overstimulated, and so not in tune with our inner deeper purpose, or, you know, God, and that's interlinked.
Also, the most important thing as well, sorry for interrupting.
No.
The most important thing as well is not only just you guys having the same religion or whatever that is, it's being on the same wavelength, spiritually speaking.
Yeah.
You need to be somewhere on that same wavelength where you and her can vibe and understand each other on a deeper level, spiritual level, you know, not just on a level of, hey, what did you do today? How was your day?
Kind of thing. Yeah.
You know?
I think what you're sort of tiptoeing around is values.
Yeah.
We've discussed that with my now wife, that in and values, you know, that this moral compass, if you will, spiritual compass, if you will, whatever you want to call it, this North Star in many ways. And if you can break it down even for a few qualities that you want to embody and you want your relationship to embody, I think unless you at least understand what each of us expects that to be, then whenever conflict arises, we are just lost.
Yeah.
Because you don't actually know where the person is coming from.
Yeah.
And I think it affects essentially everything, including, you know, all the superficial stuff such as what are we spending money on, what kind of politician is making more sense, where are we going for vacations. If you don't have that agreement, let's say, or understanding at least of your values, it's really difficult to make those decisions, man. And even with yourself, like coming back to those tricks and fasting and everything, unless you've actually taken a moment, and this is a full-on invitation for any man and woman out there to do so, if you haven't yet. Take a moment and actually ask yourself for an hour or two, sit down with a piece of paper and ask yourself, what is most important for you? What do you believe in, and what sort of qualities do you consider to be of value to the point that you're willing to commit effort to embody them? Unless you've done that exercise, at least on, you know, maybe a spiritual level, you're basically walking blind. Like, how are you playing? Are you playing based on whatever someone says at any given moment? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's so deep. It's like the foundation. It's our, I guess, morality and spirituality is the foundation of...
I don't know what researcher kind of said also, for the listeners out there, I'm very biased towards the spiritual religious aspect, towards Islam. So when I talk about my experiences or what I believe in, I'm talking from an Islamic perspective, right? Just
of
to
course.
Make that clear. The number one thing during a marriage that sustains it, one of the things is praying together.
Mm.
There was a study that some scientists talked about, some researcher talked about, is that praying together brings this level of deep connection. And it's interesting how Islam already knew that, and other religions already knew that, like how someone should, you know, be in line with your values and what and your beliefs, and how participating together in that thing could sustain a marriage.
Mm.
It's out of this place. It's weird. So
is that also not a big contrast in, because before marriage, women pray in a different room than men, right?
Yeah.
In a mosque.
Yes.
And now once you're together, you can pray together at home, I assume. At mosque, you're still going into separate.
At the mosque, she still goes with the ladies,
yeah.
And I go with the men.
But that's a huge contrast, right? Suddenly you're letting one another into the most intimate space of your life, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, just... It also, when you're praying with them, after a prayer is finished, you and her are sitting there together after a prayer, and you're just calling onto God or praying whatever it is that you're praying after the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So after you do your obligation, you're sitting there and you're just, you know, praying for these little things together, sitting together. It's so deep. It's so spiritual that I can't explain it to you unless you've actually done it. It really has strengthened our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's brought structure to both of our relationship.
I think for a more secular twist on this, something that we've been practicing...
I'm just going to grab a cup of water.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Something that we've
Cheers.
Been practicing with Yulia, and practicing, it sort of comes out of on its own, and this is also really difficult these days because people are yet again are so distracted, is like giving yourself a space every now and then, you know, make it once a month... once, whatever, you can just leave it there.
Yeah.
Once a month or once a week or every meal. For me, what prayer is sending out intentions and sort of discussing, maybe asking for answers or asking for a certain thing to happen or maybe asking for a certain thing not to happen. And... while this might be something that each of us just does internally, if we're not actually having a structured, you know, prayer time.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, what this seems like is the moment when, yet again, because of communication together, because of aligning your values together, you sketch out the things that you'd like to happen together. And I believe that when two pray, it's more powerful than when one prays, right?
I agree.
And for example,
manifesting
so,
together.
So it's sort of like it spins it out. So what we've done, for example, is we've written, a hundred different things that we'd like to do in life or have and stuff. Like I had my own list before, she had her own list before, and then we sat down together. We had those lists, and we created a list that is bringing it both together. So we know what we're aiming for. We had a little discussion back and forth. And I feel like even just doing that can offer you a great insight and an intimate insight into that person's mind, because it's not easy to write down 100 things you want. Like, I'm pretty sure by the time you hit 50, you're kind of like, I kind of have everything. And then if you align it together, you really have a roadmap in both physical, spiritual, mental, to what you'd like your life together to be.
I should do this actually tomorrow.
But these things can be, you know, as little or as big as you want. Like, three kids, we have one on the line is like three kids. Another one is like this kind of car. Another one is like, we'd like to visit this country. You know what I mean? So it can be as little or as big. Or, you know, making sure that every day we give each other a kiss. Like, as a thing that you do. Because many people, over time, end up being flatmates rather than...
True.
You know what I mean?
Life gets in the way. Gradually dies, yeah.
It's work. Mm-hmm. I think we're constantly circling back to this thing that every day is... You're taking a vote on the kind of person.
Yeah, you're working on it every day. It's work, man. Yeah, you said it beautifully. It's you need to constantly work on that relationship. A friend told me not too long ago, and that kind of shed a light on something. It doesn't matter how much you love someone, how much someone is dear to you. If you actually hold that person dear in your life, then you need to put the effort. Even if it's a mom or dad. And that kind of reminded me. I always remember him saying that to me now. He's a really dear friend back in Dubai. And when he... you know, when I'm here now, I'm away from my family. I'm away from my mom and dad. And when I remember his words, I go like, I should call my mom and dad. I should give that effort. Yeah, I know they love me. I know they know I love them, but I should call them. I should show them that I love them every day. I should put in that effort. And he said that to me because he was always calling me and stuff and checking up on me. Hey, how are you doing? Why didn't you call, man? Why aren't you calling? Like, what? And I, in my head, I'm like, come on, this guy. Like, we don't have to call every day for us to be, you know, like, you know, we're best friends. You know, we're close. Like, do I need to call you every day? But then he said, like, if you genuinely care about something, you genuinely care about someone, you need to put the effort into something, into that relationship. Or whatever. Even if you have a relationship in watering a plant, if you're watering a plant and you want that plant to live and stay and grow, then you need to check in on it every day. Yeah. Feed it, water it, like, you know, give it sunlight, make sure that soil is fine. So it's kind of the same thing.
Oh, for sure.
So it's worth any relationship you're in, any relationship you want to be in, you need to constantly give that effort.
Yeah, yeah.
It should be easy. It should be easy because it shouldn't feel like...
It should be easy because you want it, right?
Exactly.
If it's not really what you want, then it's going to be drudging. And if it's too drudging, then that's probably an... indicator that you're, you know, maybe fighting against yourself in some way.
Yeah, it could be.
Brother, at this point, I feel like we might be closing, coming to an end. But I'd like to invite you, as always, to have a little moment and maybe, is there anything else, anything in particular, something small or something big, that you'd like to leave my listeners with? Maybe something that recently you've been mulling over, or maybe an invitation, maybe whatever. Apart from checking out his podcast, which I'll link below.
Yeah, there is actually one thing. If I could give anyone any piece of advice in my, you know, very, very, very humble experience in life, very mediocre, humble experience in life, would be always... do your own thing and learn when to not listen to other people. I think that's very, very important, and that should settle in with me. I took time to settle in with me because every time I listened to other people's views, it would bring me down and I would like kind of just like run away from what I wanted to do. Don't look at what other people are doing. It's their path. It's their journey. It's not your journey. They're not you. They don't think like you. They don't have the same life that you do. They don't have the same way of thinking. They've not been exposed to life the way that you've been exposed to life. So trust you, I guess. Do what you want to do. Look at... there's a reason why you're having a vision of how you want things to be, is because, you know, God or whatever you want to call it doesn't want you to listen to other people. So believe in that. Walk your path. Never mind what people are doing. Wish them well. Be there for people. Do good. And just listen to yourself and walk. Create your own path is what I would say. Because I would tell myself that. I would tell my 10-year-old self that. So yeah, I'll close with that.
That's awesome. And that's so much, and yeah, I resonate with that deeply. It's not easy, eh? I don't really think it's easy. Anyway, guys, thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to click that subscribe and whatever button you're using on your platform. It helps for sure. And I'll link below the previous interview conversation we've done, and also Rami's show. So check it out. There are some really, really cool chats there as well.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you.